I think that longing to belong somewhere, right? That longing to be part of something bigger than ourselves is so key to the sort of spiritual landscape that we're in and the questions that so many people are asking. Hello and welcome to The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and this is a podcast about our deep values and the principles that shape those who are shaping our common life. But we have been in a series that's a little bit different. I have been talking to guests about the way that I have structured the chapters in my new book, Fully Alive, Tending to the Soul in Turbulent Times. That is a playful take on the seven deadly sins as a way of thinking about how we can be becoming the kind of people we want to be, the kind of people that the world might need, how we might be growing up our souls. And in this last episode of the series, we have something special for you. I wanted to talk to someone about my chapter on pride, which is, I think about it as moving from individualism to community, moving towards connection, which is my definition of fully aliveness. And I couldn't think of anyone better than my housemates. In that chapter, I talk about the ways that I have found to build strong community in ways that are providing steadiness for my soul. One of those is my Christian congregation, and one of those is the small intentional community that I live in with my husband and kids and two other people that you are about to meet. I tell the full story of that in the book, and you can check it out there. But we had a conversation around what we'd learned, and it was really fun. So I hope you enjoy listening. Hey, guys. Hello, friends. Hello. Sitting in our house in this unusual setup for us. This is just how we hang out, isn't it?
In our house, all the time.
We always, every conversation we have mics. I am going to ask you the kickoff question for this series, which is, what makes you feel fully alive, or what does fully aliveness mean to you? And I'm going to go to Ramsey first.
I'd say something about...
I'm so sorry.
Yeah.
I realise this is conciseness. Something about being around people and seeing other people come fully alive. I don't know. That feels like a thing.
It's a great thing.
Okay.
We can circle back if we need, if you have more to say.
Yeah, probably.
What about you, Hattie?
If I'm allowed two, one would be probably being in this house with lots of people in it and seeing people that I know from different spheres of life meeting each other and enjoying baked goods that I've made in some way or another. And the other would be probably being upstairs in my bedroom by myself, creating something, like writing something, writing someone a letter or listening to an album that speaks to me.
Thank you.
It's such a big question though, isn't it?
Yeah. I love a big question.
Yeah.
That's the point. You can't have a polished answer. It's okay. Should just start you thinking about something. Mm. What about you, Chris?
I mean, panicking right now. I don't feel like a good reporter of these things, but joy? I singing a song with my kids, looking up at the sky, stopping and smelling the roses.
Yeah.
Want to get a bit more existential? When you voice a sincere question, that for me is pretty close to the root.
Yeah, something sacred there. Thanks, friends.
What makes you feel fully alive, Liz?
Thanks, Hattie. I honestly do think it's evolving, and the sort of formal definition is deep connection, is relationship. Feeling like I'm actually in relationship with my own soul, not numbing or distracting from the things I really long for or denying. Relationship with other people, relationship with you guys. We have spent a lot of time setting this up laughing, and I think the laughter that I found in community as is a real gift, but also moments of intimacy, transparency, like navigating through conflict well with courage, actually, even though it's not comfortable, there's some aliveness in that because you're not retreating or disconnecting. and their relationship with God in those moments of quiet. Mm. On my knees, just a sense of encounter with love beyond me. Monday night dinner is a key. Mm. It's a key time. Mm. A house full of people who don't necessarily know each other. A little bit of time in silence, table full of food, an opportunity to pray compline if they want to, or just to have real questions, ask real questions, get to depth, all those things.
I mean, I remember a time back in our early in our marriage, and I was like, you know, oh, you don't understand the depth of the, you know, struggle and the existential, and you brought me different things to try and figure out what was going on. And then you brought me some cheese. And I had some cheese. And I like perked right up.
Yeah.
And I'd like to think I'm more complicated than that. But yeah. Sometimes I love the surprise of what brings you out. I was sitting there and I can't remember. Was it with you?
Give me a clue.
And then the kids came in.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Chopped
and
up.
We were talking about our anxieties. And then they came in with the little... washing basket, and they just climbed all over me and they got me to stand in the washing basket.
Well, they're just they the kind of
clowns
they?
Of these guys.
And they wanted chopped up daddy, roasted.
Think, yeah, chopped up daddy, I mean, psychoanalyze that. Yeah. Yeah. I just, maybe taking yourself less seriously.
Yeah.
Mm. The freedom to just do that. I remember someone saying, there's a people who don't take the living love of God seriously take themselves far too seriously. Mm-hmm. And I think there's an amazing freedom in not being able to hold things together and that being okay. Mm. And just chuckling at how good it is that you don't have to.
Yeah.
Thanks. That comes to mind.
Well, I'm sure we'll come back to some of that. The fact that we know that some people get hangry. You get existential despair. if we feed you, the grief of the world that overwhelms you will ebb somewhat. And all the things we know about each other now, having been living together 3 years. Mm. But let's fill in a little bit of our journey, because it is not a standard thing to be living at the level of closeness and covenant and commitment that we are. So maybe I'll start with you, Ramsey, because you have both lived with us in our kind of micro-monastery intentional community and in a different setting before. What got you interested? What is pulling you to wanting to live in these more radically interconnected ways?
Well, I mean, I think there's many answers to that. One of them would be a few years ago, a few friends, our experience of London was you might live in London, but you never see the people you live with.
Yeah. And see your friends.
Right, that's it. And you can either exploit the culture of a city, and there's all these different things you can do. You go and do all the gigs and all that. And then you maybe you wear yourself out, or you get abused by it because you want so much but feel trapped by the pace of it. And so there's this loneliness thing. And so a few of us just got together and asked the question, what would it be like if we were just a bit more deliberate about living intentionally together? So that started a bit of a journey, and then a few of us bundled into a house. We all shared, I think it was a 6-bedroom house in Streatham, and three of us guys shared one of the rooms, which gave us enough space for as many other people to pile in as well. I think we 17 people in the house was the record. Anyway, all that to say, I think there's something about living in these close relationships that unlocks something of what it is to be fully alive. Mm. This, you know, when I'm sort of separated and living a nice, and they life
autonomous
on my own. Yeah, it turns out I lose something by that, and where there's the friction, it means that there's intimacy, and that's I think that's what we're designed for. I think that's probably a part.
Resistance to loneliness is how I would
say.
And choosing intimacy, choosing it intentionally to be vulnerable and witnessing each other. Hattie, you also lived in a community house previously. How did it change what you were able to imagine? How did it shift your kind of plausibility structures about the way we live?
So I think I'd often found myself in community type situations growing up anyway. So the nuts and bolts of living together harmoniously with a lot of people was something that I was used to. I have an extended family and we'd all pile into a big house together every summer and have to figure out how to allow the big personalities to get along together for a month. And we often had kind of guests and visitors coming to stay in our family home for weeks or months at a time. But the house that I moved into in Oval in, I think it was 2017 to 2018, expanded my understanding of what it means together, particularly on that theme of intimacy, because the house, it was the first time I lived in a house where we really asked something of each other and we had to surrender some of our own personal freedom in order to experience the life of the community. So before I moved in, I went around a few times and just made sure that it was a good sort of cultural fit. And then they explained we have, on Monday nights, we have a house night. And on once a month, we have a house day. And every Sunday afternoon, if any housemates are in London, they're expected to be at Sunday lunch. If you can't commit to those things, then this house probably won't be for you. And so obviously that grates a little bit against the lifestyle of London, which can just be very fast paced and each person to themselves.
Changing plans and flaking and canceling.
Exactly, yeah. Keeping things as open as possible. But that little sacrifice and that little, oh no, I'm never free on a Monday, sorry, actually created this container that meant that we like belonged to something. And so I would say that belonging was the thing that I really found in that house. And I remember actually 2 weeks in a row, I did miss house nights. One, because I had to work. And two was because there were some sort of limited availability tickets to some big show that my friend really wanted to take me to. And so 2 weeks in a row, I said, house, I'm really sorry, but please can I be excused from house night? And they said, yes, that's fine. Obviously, we're not going to force anything on you. But I remember the leader of the community, there was a married couple, and one of them came to me and said, I just wanted to bring up that you're missing two house nights in a row. And I sort of anxiously, you know, said, oh, I'm really sorry that I'm missing doing house chores together, because that's what we do on a Monday night, as well as the conversational stuff. I'll catch up on them another time, I promise. I'll do the hoovering midweek. And he was just like, oh, we don't care about the chores. That means nothing to us. We can do the hoovering. That doesn't matter. What we miss is the hattiness of Hattie at the table on that Monday night. And I just never been faced with that kind of his kindness and generosity towards wanting to have me around just because of who I am. You know, that's a bit of a wound that I have from childhood. So I felt something getting healed in that moment of just like, oh, they just love having me around, not because I'm particularly special or anything, but because I'm a member of the household and I belong here. It's amazing.
Yeah, I think that longing to belong somewhere, right? That longing to be part of something bigger than ourselves is so key to the sort of spiritual landscape that we're in and the questions that so many people are asking. And previous generations might have found that in their village, right? Or their little bit of town where they lived all their life, or in their job, they might have had a labour union or a guild, or they might have found it in a local congregation, much more likely to have been part of a worshipping congregation. Mm. And none of that's given to us, right? We have to do a lot of this finding things for ourselves, self-actualizing, creating chosen family. But there's all these pressures that are continually pulling us apart, making it actually really hard to commit, to belong, to have a sense of close-up intimacy with more than a romantic partner, which is a fine thing, but one, not available to everyone, not always a lifetime thing for a series of complex reasons, and not enough on its own. Chris, we had some more structural reasons for wanting to explore living communally. Do you want to say a little bit about those?
Kind of pragmatic desire to live more affordably, sustainably, communally, came out of some of the kind of, not just practical constraints. I mean, we are immensely privileged, and we have a lot of power and wealth and choice that a lot of people don't have. And we were able to use and leverage that access to equity, for example, to buy a flat like 10 years ago or so, 11 years ago, which...
Lots of people can't.
Yeah, right. Housing ownership models are just not working for a lot of people. And we were the ones for whom, when the Ginger Line came in around here, like suddenly house prices rocketed. And we are winners in the gentrification game, which is a terrible game. There's a lot of losers. And we are now systematically invested in a future that I hate. And we're profiting from it. And I remember thinking that before we were considering options and thinking, well, what's the way out? Like, can you rent, but you're still systematically investing in an unjust system, and we're investing and profiting from a future that is structurally unjust? And I just did not know. There was like no out.
You have to live somewhere.
And those of us who can come when we can, and if those of us who can go when we can, then we'll just reproduce a bunch of cultural norms that I think we're called to disrupt and to creatively disrupt and to reimagine. But if those of us come when we can, go when we can, and those who can't, like those who have no power and wealth and differential of choice, they're just shunted around. And I'm complicit in that. And we are complicit in that, and our children are complicit in that. And that bothered me deeply. And I there's a line, I think C.S. Lewis said, that those who, what I so proudly call myself, becomes merely the meeting point of a train of events that I didn't start and I can't stop. And that kind of grim sense of inevitability, of am I just reproducing the utterly predictable paths that have been trod?
Yeah, the sense we had that we have a climate crisis and a lonely crisis and a housing crisis. And in our language, in our world, a discipleship crisis, right? We purport to have this faith that actually very often is just something around the edges of our lives. Right. And I think that you're right. That is what drove us to think, gosh, there must be, what would it mean to be creative? What would it mean to try and disrupt some of these pressures and these tram tracks and these tides that are continually pulling us apart from each other and encouraging us to live these individualized lives of choice and autonomy insofar as those are accessible to us, depending on our class and inherited wealth. What would it mean to actively choose towards interdependence, right, to choose to commit to an area, to choose to commit to a bunch of people? And in the book, the definition I have of pride is, it's almost the same as my definition of sin, which is disconnection, is our tendency to want to... Luther and Augustine have this Latin phrase, homo incarnatus in se, which is humans turned in on themselves. Right. I think we are made for relationship. We are interdependent creatures. And that's partly because of my theological anthropology, but also you will get that in sociology. You'll get it in neuroscience, right? We're hypersocial. We are not actually free, rational acting individuals. We are informed by each other, forming each other. Our choices are about who we're in relationship with, all these things. What would it mean to move towards those things? And so that pride, which makes us want to deny that fact, to say we are, no, I'm not interdependent. I don't need anyone and no one needs me. I'm just going to carve my own path as a rugged individual. That's pride for me. And so living in community like we do, and also being part of a local congregation, but there's other ways to do this, is the way I think about it, is pride prevention medicine. It continually reminds us of our interdependence and makes it difficult for us to turn in on ourselves. So I just wanted to talk to you guys a bit about that and say, what's your experience of that being in this community? You can challenge me, you can disagree with me, reflect on it a bit for me, that interdependence. Is it pride prevention medicine for you, Ramsey?
It definitely helps. I mean, I think I've got this idea that I am very competent and... I don't know, likable, and this is a particular thing that's getting me at the moment is I generally have the right way of doing things.
And, no, yeah. Things like that.
Yeah, and I find that I probably could live generally that way if I if it wasn't confronted by you guys.
And I would have gotten away with it too. Yeah, if it wasn't for those meddling kids.
Excuse me. Having to be open and have conversations about dishwashers and express my needs and say when things are upsetting me is really hard for me, but I think it's also good. This medicine that I, when I step back from it, I talk about the kind of the dream of, community. And it does, I said, it means that there's friction. It means the friction means that there's intimacy in it. And I know it's one of the things I'm made for is to be in these relationships, these close relationships. And yet it's still, it's confronting, isn't it? I mean, it's the very thing that shapes me and that I want to lean in towards is also the thing that is hard forces me to confront my conceit.
Mm. It's easy to believe, isn't it, that our granular preferences are morally superior?
Yeah.
Part of me really does believe that.
Yeah. Yes.
Problem is, when I'm faced with somebody else who has a slightly different granular preference, it turns out I've got to
adapt and compromise. Yeah. And I think, I hope it's okay to say this, that I feel like some of the hardest points we've had have led to some of the most sort of joyful and beautiful thing. Yeah. You know, when we first moved in together, the sort of moments of friction were mainly between you two, because you're quite different, and that difference would come up, and we'd have these house nights where Ramsey and I would kind of cheer you on to stay with the trouble and, keep talking.
Nailed it.
Work out what it was that you were pressing on each other and have grace for each other, but also be honest about why you were feeling pissed off or hurt or whatever it was. I feel like you did a lot of work. And then there was a period where you and I are very different and those differences were coming into conflict. And I felt like there was ugliness in me that was coming out in response to that difference. And I didn't want to admit that. that there was ugliness and selfishness and that sense of, I don't want to need you and I don't want you to need me. And this is too awkward. But the depth of our bond is sort of exponentially stronger, I think, because we stayed with it.
Yeah.
What helps in those moments, Hattie? Talk to me about vulnerability, because you can't help but be vulnerable living up as close as we do. Mm. Where does that show up and what have you learned about it?
So as you've been speaking, I've been thinking about a moment that I realised that my definition of success had a crack in it. And so, and this was quite a long time ago. I have a lot of cousins who live abroad and they're varying degrees of quite successful in their industries. And I was probably a late teenager. And I just remember the water that I was swimming in, like David Foster Wallace's,
hi kids. Cultural stories.
How's the water? And the fish are like, you're good. What's water? It's like, the things that you don't realize you're living in. I've been living in this definition of success that success was living as far away from your families as you can and living as independently as you possibly can just to prove that you're strong. And I was like, if I can, how can I do that? And part of that led me to really want to pursue a career in the army for a long time and all sorts of things. Just because that was the sort of cultural and family narrative that I thought I was receiving. Maybe it's not true necessarily now, but that's certainly what I picked up when I was a teenager. And that led me to I'd say that I found myself in a position, particularly when we were getting ready to get married, where I just realized that I actually didn't really know how to let myself be loved or be seen, because I spent my whole life trying to present this image to the world that I was competent and independent and self-sufficient and didn't need anyone, because that's, a safer way to live. If you don't need anyone, then you don't get let down by anyone. And yeah, I remember the moment that I realized, that's what I'm believing. Do I actually believe that? And I started questioning whether I did. And then that's obviously led me on this journey to actually living in community and independence. And it was a quote by C.S. Lewis that really like hit home, which was about to love anything is to be vulnerable. And you can choose to love nothing, but your heart will become like it's encased in a coffin. It will become cold and impenetrable, unmoved by anything. To love is to be vulnerable. And I was like, oh, I think I'm maybe on my way there, and I don't want to be. And living in community, if you choose, living in a healthy community just doesn't let you do that. So I think vulnerability is something that I've learnt and come to enjoy and to love. I don't know what else to say other than it's become as natural to me as breathing. It's the water that I swim in now that I'm choosing to swim in, because it's what creates connection. And connection is how communities are formed and sustain themselves.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't have a real relationship without it, right? It's just all a show.
I just feel like some of that is, you know, our marriage, which is a form of community as well. But then I'd say probably, you know, just expand the circle of close relationships, and that in some way amplifies at like the, you know, the value of the or the potential for it being vulnerable, and therefore potentially the growth.
Yeah. So some people listening will be genuinely community curious and want to think about living in these more interdependent ways themselves. And we'd love to talk to people about that and be as helpful as we can. But for a lot of people, I think they just want to work out how to live more relationally and with more connection and resist that disconnecting pride without necessarily having to move into a commune. So Chris, what do you think we've learned that might be useful for people just seeking more connection, more relationship, more vulnerability and intimacy in their friendships or their neighbourhoods or their workplaces or their romantic relationships?
I mean, do we need to talk about the prunes? We meet each week and we have several rhythms, but one of them is a weekly house night on Wednesday. And we started living together during lockdown 2, was it? Ledger Avenue 3. And then Boris Council Christmas, and we were suddenly in rental accommodation, stuck with each other, and it was really rich. It was like going camping and just having this offline, real experience of each other. And we had the time to not just numb out, although we watch a lot of films and listen to a lot of music, like we listen to each other and got to know each other, and that we don't do that enough, actually.
Yeah, I think we need to go back to that practice of finding the pressure valves. I think the joke that we have about being the Order of Saint Brene, because Brene says clarity is kindness, and the thing that I have found has made our marriage better and my other friendships better is this sense that in community, if things are unsaid, they will fester, you know, that eventually they will come out, and they might come out through passive aggression or sideways. And I think we need to pay more attention to our pressure valves because we haven't been spending so much time on them. But the ability to have enough trust and a strong enough container to want to normalize friction and to say we are expecting to annoy each other, and that doesn't mean we don't love each other or respect each other. And it is not a threat to our connection, to our relationship, that actually the if there was no friction, we would not be close enough, right? That you talk about frictionful, not frictionless, that the formation to avoid all annoyance, to avoid all difference, to avoid all conflict and disagreement, because they're short-term quite uncomfortable.
Which, can I say, is where our culture is heading against. Like, I work in technology, and so much of the things that we design are to reduce the friction.
Yeah.
We went to a restaurant last night and you pay, you don't speak to your
human in the eyes.
You scan a QR code, you go through the process, you pay on your phone without ever having to speak to the human.
Mm.
And we are moving in the direction where we are reducing the amount of friction.
Yeah.
That is not good, surely, for us.
Yeah.
Yeah. Saint Brene tells a story of like a Silicon Valley guy coming up to her and saying, I want to create an app that, you know, removes the painful side of vulnerability from life. And she was like, no, you can't do that. You can use another word, but you can't use the word vulnerability if you're trying to remove the painful part of it, because it is painful and awkward and embarrassing to be vulnerable. That's kind of the whole point of it. I don't know whether it's helpful to mention at the moment of like some of the Sabbath practices that we try and do as a house. Nice. And I mean, particularly the one that we find the hardest, but that we try the hardest to do, is to maybe all turn our phones off on a Friday night. And then have brunch together on a Saturday morning. And even that little act of resistance is just so good. And it's that would be an example of a soft skill that people could start implementing now, even if they're not living in a commune. But if you're wanting to be, you know, moving away from pride and towards love, one of the ways to do that is to not let yourself be distracted and not give in to that asbestosy lie that life is all about being completely frictionless and completely easy. And that's just what our phones suck us into thinking all the time. Like, how can I make this the easiest possible experience of my life? In other words, how can I remove all of the like human awkwardness?
It's possible that the pride prevention medicine that other people can apply to their lives is, even if you're not living in the same place as someone, finding collective practices, finding people who you want to be in deeper relationship with and saying, can we commit to something? Can we commit to baking a loaf of bread and having a meal on a Friday night? Can we commit to turning off our phones together for this period of time? Can we commit to, studying the scriptures of our tradition together, or praying together, or going for a long walk together, or going to sit round a campfire in the woods together and have a real conversation once a month?
Or join the longest queue at a supermarket.
Random, but okay.
Well, it goes against the grain.
Yeah, like... yeah. Well, how do we find these moments of disruption and resistance to all the forces that are trying to pull us apart and leave us with glossy, comfortable, consumer, like suffocated with consumer crap lives? And I think that sense of intention and purpose, it's actually really hard to sustain on our own. I would not be doing any of the practices that we do collectively left to my own devices.
That's
I
good.
Don't have the discipline.
Yeah.
I am too. I don't like getting out of bed. I find it hard to turn off my phone. All these things. But because there is this benign peer pressure, some of them I do. And so, I think find people who will be prepared to commit with you to collective practices and be prepared to be the intense awkward one. Because it's like asking, we basically asked you guys out. It's like asking someone out to say, will you do this quite serious thing with me? Will you maybe not, could we just have a thing where we're not going to flake for no good reason? There'll be grace if there's a good reason, but the default will be, we will show up. We will show up to this collective practice and we'll take it seriously and we will make it an important thing in our lives because we think it's important for the kind of people we want to be becoming together. Let's leave with one question about the hardest, start with the hardest, and then finish on the best thing about living in these more communal ways.
Best thing is you guys and the courage that it gives. Each one of us has been able to endure hard things and be known and to be held and be that little bit braver. I think ways of life are imitative. We imitate what we've seen. But we've never seen this. I didn't grow up seeing this. A lot of people have. A lot of people, there's so much wisdom in people who've shed, you know, live much more communally than we have.
Yeah. Elsewhere in the world, and people who have less financial reason to be able to be independent, have had to be interdependent. They've been forced to care for each other.
And making that a place, like I want to grow into a way of living together that isn't built on human power and wealth and choice, and like trying to leverage what little we have to create some sort of structure that will make it easier for us to learn the wisdom of people who have found a wisdom and ways of living that haven't had that access and have found ways to flourish in ways that can help us unlearn the kind of
the pride.
The pride, right?
Yeah.
Like we've been sort of educated into imbecility in a way.
Yeah.
Like we need to unlearn some of that, and just the ability to learn from that, participate in something and share that. And learn the wisdom of so many people who have done that in this and many other cities.
Thanks, Chris.
Is great.
Hattie, hardest thing and then best thing?
I'll start with my hardest thing, which is, as possibly the most introverted housemate, and this is a question that we get a lot from people, is like, but I'm an introvert, therefore I can't live in community. I just want to snip that in the bud and say that's not true. So don't exclude yourself for that reason. There could be other reasons that you're excluding yourself, but that shouldn't be one of them. Probably the hardest thing is just wanting to sit at the dining room table and have a breakfast to myself. And I can't do that if I choose to have my breakfast between 7:30 and 8:30 in the morning, which I often do. So just, like the uncertainty of when I might have like a bigger space to myself is probably the thing I find hardest.
Mm.
And the best thing on top of everything Chris has already said, because that's all really true. I would probably second the sort of the support aspect of it. And not just for myself and feeling like I belong and like I'm celebrated for who I am and encouraged to be, you know, the brightest version of myself that I can be, the most fully alive version of myself that I can be. Also support for, you know, Ramsey, my husband, because I remember when we were living together, just us in that first lockdown, and your best friend had just passed away and you were working incredibly hard. And I was drowning under the weight of being the only one that you could offload to. And then we moved in with these guys. And in lockdown 3, I was just like, I could breathe out a sigh of relief because, we're not designed to create, to hold that kind of weight for each other, to be that kind of codependent. Moving into a community and the support that, you know, the Oldfields have of us and that we have of the Oldfields, and it's just, that's the most beautiful thing, I think, for me.
About you, Ramsey?
So, hardest thing, probably sharing hard things. Just as you say, I find it much easier to internalize and much easier to just go, in my head, this is the cost of living in community. It's just what we do. And then it all builds up. And then, actually, trying to express the things that I find difficult is difficult.
Mm-hmm.
So, moving on from that.
Nothing hard now. Nothing's annoying me at all.
I mean, there's so many best things being able to go, hey, we live in the Oldfields. That's like a gift. and getting to introduce our friends, getting caught up in the wider, I don't know, community that is not just like the 2 or the 4 or the 6, but like 100, you know, being mothered by your mother and, and yours and yours, and, you know, that, and mine, of course, I hasten to add. And I think the default being that when I get home, there'll probably be someone around rather than me having to seek out, okay, if I want connection, it's much easier to have. Mm. Not automatic, we still got to work at it, but it's the default. I think that's That's been a wonderful gift. And then also, we're not parents, and yet we get a parenting masterclass just in a kind of live environment going, huh, oh, that's how you do that. Or
that's how you don't.
Yeah.
Well, I mean,
do that differently.
I'm looking forward to the kind of parenting book or workshop or course that you'll put on something. But it's just been, I mean, there's so many best things. But those be some.
Thanks, Rams. I find the hardest thing is being confronted with the bits of myself that are difficult to live with, that I'd rather not know about. You know, I'm not naturally tidy and I try really hard, but if I'm distracted, I'm not. And you guys are so gracious, but understandably, sometimes you're like, that's not right. I'm like, you're right. That is entirely justified. Also, I want to be messy when I want to be messy. Yeah, this is the shame that kicks in, right? When you realise there are things about yourself that are not lovely. Mm. I'm learning to have that be okay, because it's always, there's the container is strong enough, right? There's enough trust and love, and I know you're not going to reject me because I'm not naturally tidy. But still, so many best things, but I would say the way, I really need to find an alternative to economies of scale because it's too mechanistic. But somewhat more organic biological metaphor for the fact there's just more caring capacities go around.
Mm-hmm.
We have four adults doing the chores that two adults would do if they were living in this household. And we have a wider range of skills and a wider range of people to ask for help. And when someone's in crisis, it's actually quite easy to say yes. When we know that, like Hattie was saying, there's more care and there's more energy and there's more love. And when one of us is really under the cosh and has no capacity whatsoever, there's still three of us. And that sense of the sort of slight loaves and fishes effect of pooling what we have. And then it's not like then it gets divided by four. It's more like there's 8 or 16. We are more able to love our neighbours, more able to be hospitable, more able to step up to help other people. Because we have each other's backs, and that is a great gift to me.
Yeah.
Friends, I feel like this is just a recording of an ongoing conversation with us, so we will carry on. But for now, thank you for doing the slightly weird thing, which is sitting in our house with the microphones in front of us, and being my very special guests on today's special Fully Alive episode of The Sacred.
Amen.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for listening to this special episode of The Sacred. My name is Elizabeth Oldfield, and you have been listening to a series themed around my book, Fully Alive. I'm so grateful for those of you who've been in conversation with me about it on Substack, on social media, any of you who've picked it up and wanted to have a conversation about it. I really hope that those will continue as we take a little break. In the UK, it'll be over the summer. I don't know where in the world you are, but we will be back sometime in September, returning to our normal format. Just wanted to say a huge thanks to our production team, without which this podcast and the accompanying assets and all the other activity that goes on around it would not exist. Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, Amari Gandran, and Chinny McDonald, and the wider Theos team who support what we do so wonderfully. Please do go check out their work and our sister podcast, Reading Our Times. Until the next series, have a wonderful break.